Members, the Committee on Local Government Metropolitan Affairs will come to order. And we have Representative Schumper to present his bill, House File 3402.
We can't move it or anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. If we can't move it, we don't have a quorum yet, but if you can present your bill to the committee, that would be greatly appreciated.
I will, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ken Schumper. House File 3502, members, has to deal with a request for a local sales tax for the community of Lanesboro, which is in my district. Lanesboro has become quite a tourist attraction, and they've had a lot of increased demand on their roads and bridges within their community, and they simply need more revenue in order to sustain and maintain their roads. And so they're proposing a half-cent sales tax for the community, which would bring in about $1.4 million that they could use for improvements in the community. It's pretty much like most of the local option sales tax that we've seen come through this committee. So if there are any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Representative Schumper? Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against House File 3402? All right, seeing none, we can't move it right now or anything, but anything else you care to add? Or?
No, I think it's all pretty well covered in the brief or the overview. Creates bonding authority for the city, terminates when the revenue comes in enough for them to pay off the bond. So,
very good. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Reinert, you're next with House File 3399.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Our 5 minutes here, I'll take about 30 seconds and then hand it over to my city manager. But this bill, as you can see, authorizes the extension of our sales and use tax, modifies its use to the improving Riverfront 2000 facilities, which is our civic center, which has been in existence since 95, and we're looking to build a theater and women's hockey exposition center, which are part of our downtown redevelopment plan and very critical to regional economic development. And we also include a food and beverage tax that to support the ongoing operating expenses of the Civic Center. And I'm going to allow Pat Hentges, who's our city manager, to give you a fuller view of the proposal.
Welcome, Mr. Hentges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you give your name?
Hentges. H-E-N-T-G-E-S Patrick, the city manager in Mankato, Minnesota. Just wanted to kind of highlight a couple things about this bill. We've had sales tax for approximately two projects in about almost 15 years now. One of the important things to note is that this is one of the foremost projects in the use of local option sales tax, and that it was a partnership with the state of Minnesota and Minnesota State University, or Mankato State University at the time. And we think it was a very valid use of sales tax. It's worked out well, certainly for the state and Minnesota State, in that we essentially constructed a facility without bonding money and allowed for the program to evolve to Division I hockey. Similarly, we have a theater complex, proposed a performing arts theater complex that would be used in conjunction with Minnesota State University along with regional uses. So we think it's a very good use of the local option sales tax, because there is benefit not only to the local region, but certainly to the state of Minnesota and specifically Minnesota State University. The women's program is in dire needs of a facility, and that they operate in a community facility now, and from a gender equity standpoint, we cannot accommodate them in our main arena, and essentially taking away from some community assets. The city, when that program came in place, we embraced it and allowed space in our local arena, in fact even helped construct them at our cost. So we were very excited again about this partnership and continuing this partnership, and we look forward to the opportunity to extend the sales tax for this venture.
Any Ms. questions?
Representative Bryan, did you have any more comments?
No, I just wondered if there were any questions from your members, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone, any members, any questions, comments? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak for or against? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Biskin. You have to raise your hand a little higher, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bryan, on page 2, line 19, and again on line 25, we are not withstanding law, charter, a specific statute, ordinance, city charter, or other provisions of law. Basically, the caveat or other provisions of law negates the notwithstanding on any specific statute that may be in here. But what are we notwithstanding? What are we trying to get out of here that's currently written into law?
Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, this was drawn up by House Research, and I don't have a clue what we're trying to get out of. So if my city manager has a thought, I'll pass it to him.
I probably, in reading that, I think, just generally speaking, if there's another provision of law, at least within our charter, that prevented us from implementing or imposing that 1% tax, that would prevail, but I am not aware of anything in any local ordinances, city charter, and I don't know, you know, in reference to the reviser and identifying other provisions of law, I don't know if there's anything that would impose, would prevent this if it, we were given authority to do it. There are other cities that have that type of hospitality tax, as I would refer to it, and we received it through authority in the state of
Minnesota. Ms. Lefevre, do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I know that section 477A.016 is in the local government aid section, and it's a blanket prohibition on new taxes for counties, cities, towns, or other taxing authorities. The others, I think it's just boilerplate that's used to make sure that this supersedes that sort of provision or any other provision in the city charter.
We now have a quorum, and so I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Biskins, did you have another question?
I did, Mr. Chair, and maybe Representative Bryan-Hart would know the answer to this. On other local option sales tax, Representative, is there a requirement to hold a referendum prior to it being imposed, and are we trying to get out of a referendum requirement?
Representative Bryant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, we're not trying to get out of a referendum requirement, and there's a history of reverse referendum in Mankato that I'm going to let the city manager speak to, because we've addressed this three times in the past.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had essentially three referendums in Mankato regarding the extension and use of the local option sales tax. In this particular case, we are not changing the use, we're just extending the time period. In the previous referendum that passed, I guess the last two referendums passed with super, super majorities, and essentially the use is always been the same. And so in this particular case, we've had three referendums on the use of the sales tax.
Just Representative Biskins, first I'm going to move that House File 399 be referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. And Representative Biskin, your next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I figured it would go to taxes. But the one thing that I really have a concern with, and I think it's a concern for this committee, is that a number of bills that have come before us similar to this, or bills that deal with the change and makeup of local units of government and or if a position will be appointed or elected, all of those bills have had reverse referendum within them. Here we have a bill asking for an extension of the sales tax, and you know, we in the 2 years, a year and a half I've been on this committee, we haven't had a referendum as a standard policy. However, most of them, to the best of my knowledge, have had reverse referendum based on a level of petition. This bill before us here has no such provision, and that concerns me, and I just wanted to express that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Greiner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, we certainly would amend the proposal to include a reverse referendum. So that would not be an issue for us at all.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Reinhart. And that might help smooth its sailing in taxes. So maybe between now and taxes, if that's something that you're amenable to.
Mr. Yes, Chair, I would just note that later on in the legislation that this was drafted off of, there is a provision regarding reverse referendum, because it's the city elected to have a referendum the first time around, even though there wasn't sufficient signatures for a reverse referendum, and it did pass, again, support. We could simply resurrect that language quite easily, I'm sure, with the revisor.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is the concern that I have with that word "or other provision of law." That phrase then exempted from anything else which may have been on the book.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill, House File 3399? Okay. Seeing no one, I will renew my motion that House File 3399 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Certainly. Okay. Being that I presented my bill before we had a quorum, I will move House File 3402 and that it be referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. I'll ask again, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3402? Seeing and hearing no one, I will again renew my motion that House File 3402 be referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendations. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Dabney, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to share?
Sure.
Welcome, Representative Dabney. I will move that House File 3220 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3220 before you today. This bill simply authorizes political subdivisions to give money or make in-kind grants to nonprofit organizations, 501c3 organizations, if the grant is for a public purpose, to support educational, social service, health, or other charitable purposes in their local community. It does require that the gift be presented and voted on at a regularly scheduled meeting of the governing body and be duly recorded in that governing body's minutes. Currently, local units of government, depending on what level of government they are allowed to make gifts of this sort depending on who they are giving to. It changes whether you are a township, a city, a county, so on. This would leave the authority at the local level. With me today, Madam Chair, is Ms. Jeannie Fox from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, who can explain the bill further.
All right. Go ahead, state it for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and the sponsor here. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Public Policy Director for the Council of Nonprofits. And thank you for letting me speak to this bill today. As Representative Dabney said, the bill basically clarifies the expenditure authority of local units of government to give to an organization as long as the organization is a 501c3 organization and that the purpose is to the public purpose. And this bill refers to a specific type of nonprofit, namely a charity, who are eligible to receive federal corporate income tax exemptions on the basis of that they serve charitable, religious, scientific, or educational purposes, and that no one person or entity benefits from their operations. So we know that, as Representative Dabney said, there are a handful or so of attorney general opinions and statutes that exist that say yes, you can to this particular type of organization or this particular type of organization, and we would like to not encourage, you know, the 4,500 from nonprofits in Minnesota to be seeking their own bill. So this law would give the authority to the local unit of government who we think know their community best and how organizations can help fulfill those needs. And we think it's not always clear to local elected officials. I've seen the minutes of different county boards, et cetera, where they grapple with this issue. And in one case, you know, the commissioners are recorded as having this discussion about, well, I'd like to give money to this organization. They do good work in our community, and I'd like to give money to this organization. So they, you know, allocated like $2,000 to each of them, and then later, based on council's advice, rescinded money because one of the organizations didn't meet the statutory, an existing statutory requirement. So we think this would do away with that. They could do what they feel is best for their community. Thank you.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3220 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general list. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, next is House File 2662, Representative Peterson. All right, Representative Peterson, I will move that House File 2662 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. I believe you have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. A1H2662A1 amendment.
I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is pretty straightforward. It calls for staggered four-year terms for members of the Metropolitan Council, and currently the members' terms end with the term of the governor. And so this would change that process and allow for more continuity. And we have, and I will fill in where our speakers, we have three speakers here today. I'll let them give you some of the background, and if there's anything missing, I will complete the discussion.
All right, who's going first?
Madam Chair, members, good afternoon. My name is Jim Fulham. I live at 1975 Autumn Street in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. I don't work for any organization, and I don't represent any organization. I have the luxury of being retired. But I was the first regional administrator at the Metropolitan Council, served in that position from July of 94 to July of 2000 under three chairs, and I'm the only regional administrator to have gone through a change in governors. And I support this legislation because I think the addition of continuity is very important. In 1994, the legislature merged four organizations into one, created a single governing body and a single administrative structure. So the council now operates two of the largest infrastructure systems for the region, substantial regional park system, housing authority, and on and on. The current budget is about $670 million. It has more than a dozen labor agreements and close to 3,000 employees. In 94, the legislature solved, or at least substantially solved, the problems of accountability. You did not, however, deal with the problem of continuity. And I think that's an issue that needs to be solved. As I said, I'm the only regional administrator to have gone through a change in governors, at which time there was a retention of three council members by Governor Ventura from the Carlson appointees, and I can testify to the fact that it takes a very long time and an enormous amount of work to bring a new governing body up to speed in an organization with this size and complexity. I think it's the only government entity in the state that has the possibility of having its entire governing structure and senior administration change at the same time. So I believe this is a responsible legislation. It's good fiscal management, and I think you should pass it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who's next?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Steve Larson, Mayor of New Brighton. This is my 21st year as an elected official, and I also agree with Mr. Solem's comment about continuity. I believe it's important for an organization such as the Met Council to have people that actually overlap on terms. First of all, it gives credibility to what the past councils have decided was a vision, and you're not starting over. And I think what's really important, this should be driven by the council members instead of staff. I think there's a lot of times you can get staff that are basically doing a project versus an ongoing effort by a council member. And a staggered term would help address some of that so you have more continuity from one administration to another.
And next, please state your name for the record.
Terry Schneider. I'm a city council member in the city of Minnetonka. I've been on the council for 15 years. Also a past president of the Metro Cities, and also in the past served on the as the chair of the Met agency's subcommittee, which actually debated this whole issue several years ago to formulate our policy. And I was able to also serve on a couple of Met Council committees, the Transportation Advisory Board and the Open Space Board. And again, I would like to echo the same need for continuity. Primarily, there are some issues with staff. I understand that as far as who determines policy. But if a city and most cities are really focused on adopting a regional policy and a partnership to make sure that the system plan and the direction that Met Council decides is fully implemented, those decisions have significant impacts on cities' financial and their planning perspectives for many years. So to have that change course in a sudden shift of terms or makeup of the council has some devastating impacts on the overall planning and economics of the city and how we move forward. So I think this staggered terms would provide for, again, that continuity and make the long-term process more efficient.
Questions from members? Did you have something else, Representative Peterson?
No, other than I think this is common sense, Bill. And actually, when the Met Council started out, it was staggered terms. And in 1994, I believe one of the representatives put forth a bill that changed that. And so we're going back to the original concept of staggered terms, which I think does make some sense in terms of continuity. And also, I think, less partisanship, more diversity, et cetera.
Thank you, Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, I can wait if there's anyone in the audience who'd like to testify. I don't want to step on their...
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Or Mr. Zamboy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, Metro Cities. I'm here in support of the bill, of course, and I don't want to add anything. I think our testimony is pretty self-explanatory. I just wanted to offer that I'm here to help answer some questions if there are questions from the members.
All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Peterson. I'll just go on record as saying that you and I are in philosophical disagreement on this, and there probably is no way we're going to come to a meeting of the minds. We'll probably have to respectfully agree to disagree. To correct something that Mr. Sulem said, Mr. Sulem said they're the only governmental entity he knows of whose governing structure could completely change overnight. Well, I respectfully disagree. I think that happens in the House of Representatives every 2 years and in the Senate every 4 or 2 years, depending upon where we're at in the decade. The issue of continuity in the Metropolitan Council is one we really have to grapple with, all right? And that is an issue of, is the Metropolitan Council an agency of the state, or is it a separate unit of government? And the issue lies in the fact that we've never defined that, and they're kind of this pseudo entity that nobody really knows what it is. Right? If it's a separate unit of government, then I think we should clearly spell that out, and members should stand for election because they are governing, they are taxing. If they want the complete autonomy that they desire along with the taxing authority, then they should be answerable to the people. If they are an agency of the state, which some would say that they're an agency of the state, then I would, again, strongly disagree with the characterization that their governance structure is the only one that could change with an administration. The entire governance structure of the Minnesota Department of Education, its commissioner and assistant commissioners all serve at the pleasure of the governor. MnDOT's commissioners and assistant commissioners all serve at the pleasure of the governor. In fact, all state agencies' head body serve at the pleasure of the governor. And that is appropriate because they have broad power, and the elected official who stands behind that power is the governor. Right. So again, we're mixing things up here. Right? If you want to have the autonomy of a separate unit of governance, right, then we need to move in that way, and the people need to have a say in who is on that body. Right? If you want to have, if we want to keep the Metropolitan Council as an agency that is beholden to both the legislature and the executive branch, then I don't think we should be going down this path again.
Thank you, Representative Jenkins. I would like to introduce the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. They are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Capital Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. So join me in welcoming them to our committee. Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bissons, I have to say I kind of agree with you on your critique. So I do want to ask a question. I'm looking at this handout on governance from Metropolitan Council. On page one, it talks about the board is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the government. On page 117, or line 117 of the bill, it says the statement of member serves at the pleasure of the governor has been lined out. So which is it? And what does it mean that they serve at the pleasure of the government? They can be let go at any time?
Madam Chair, they do serve, but if you look at the, were you looking at the bill or the amendment?
Looking at the bill.
The amendment does have, if you look at the amendment, even though it's lined out, there is an amendment that addresses that.
Okay, I see.
So in other words, this handout is not quite correct when it says the board is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the governor. So you're nullifying that correctly?
Correct? Unless he chooses differently.
Thank you.
Further questions, remember, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of continuity is a valid one. But I also believe Representative Biskins raises a very important philosophical question here about the role of Met Council that obviously that question needs to be answered. Specifically, if you look at the amendment, there's a problem with the amendment. People currently serve, theoretically at least, through the year 2010, because that's when the current governor's term ends, at the end of 2010. And the way this language is drafted, it says members representing odd number districts serve for terms ending the first Monday in January of 2010, which means that they'd have to go earlier than what their term. They currently serve a term through 2010, correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Lanning, no, they currently serve at the will of the governor. So they, if they're not discharged by the governor, yes, they would stay until his term ends. But the current term is at the pleasure of the governor. Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand that, but theoretically, they're eligible to serve throughout the full term of the current governor.
Madam Chairman.
And so for us to put January 2010 is not right. It ought to be January 2011. And because otherwise you're forcing the governor to replace somebody that the current governor may want to see stay there until the end of his term.
Ms. LeFevre. Madam Chairman, Representative Lanning, the governor could reappoint the person. If the governor is still the governor, he could reappoint the person for an additional four-year term. It would be at that point. I guess what we're doing is this, what this bill does is to change the method of appointment and to those people whose terms were previously set under the old law would have new terms set under the new law. It does change their terms.
Yes. So technically, Representative Lanning, this governor would get to appoint his Metropolitan Council members before he leaves office, and they would stay longer even after he leaves should he not run for re-election. So this governor would get the first benefit of appointing members for longer than he was in office.
Okay.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I think to Representative Lanning's point, and I'm going to walk this through just to make sure, all right, the governor currently is governor of the state of Minnesota until through December 31st of 2010. Right? And so these numbers, if we are looking at the first Monday in January of 2010, we're actually jumping the gun by a year from when they were supposed to have expired. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Diskins. However, then, should the governor reappoint them, this person or someone else, he would get the benefit of the full term. So even though he only has 1 year left in his term, he would get the benefit of appointing the Metropolitan Council members, and they would stay the term. So he would get that benefit. Okay. Representative Diskins.
So then if I have this right, I'm going to salute Representative Peterson for reaching across the aisle, because she would then create a situation where this governor would be allowed to appoint half of the Metropolitan Council. This Republican governor would be able to appoint half of the Metropolitan Council for 3 years into the next governor's term, who may or may not be a Republican.
That is correct, Representative Diskin.
I salute you, Representative Peterson. I won't vote for it, but I salute you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Diskins, it's that sharing across the aisle that we're attempting to do here, and also the idea of continuity, and that extends even to allowing that governor to appoint half of the council for the next term, even though he might not be in there.
Further questions from members? Is there? I see that Judd is now here, Mr. Stettman, but I'm going to ask if is anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I got a little confused here, and maybe you can explain. What's the difference between reappointment and end of term? If we're deciding on someone that their term is ending on 2010, but yet get reappointed, that's where I'm confused. How does that work?
Representative Peterson, do you want to take that question?
I'm going to see if one of the other gentlemen here is
Staff, you want to?
I'm not quite understanding the question, so.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dominguez, I think that the way that the transitional language is crafted here, some of the members' terms would expire on first Monday of January 2010. And then at that point, the governor, whoever is the governor, would have the right to appoint someone for an additional 4-year term to fill that seat. So he could appoint the same person who would then serve an additional 4 years, or he could appoint someone else who would serve in that capacity for 4 years. Representative Dixon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is a good explanation, but as Representative Holberg and I just figured out, we did not, of course, strike the entire line on page 1, line 13. So in effect, because of the next apportionment, all terms are going to expire in 2012.
You are correct, Representative. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But if the next governor came in at 2010 and wanted somebody different, he could simply disband those members and reappoint new. I mean, is the term forever, or can they be changed?
Ms. Lefevre.
Madam Chairman, Representative Scalzi, the terms would be 4-year fixed terms. A member would only be able to be removed for cause. It wouldn't be at the pleasure of the governor anymore the way it currently is.
Questions from members? All right, hearing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2662 be recommended to pass and as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Peterson. All right, next on the agenda, we're going to skip my bill because we're going to move to Representative Scalzi. Now, Representative Scalzi, there are a lot of people that have contacted us about testifying either for or against the bill. So what I'm going to ask is everyone that's in the room, I'm going to ask you to stick to the issues that are local government related. So go ahead, Representative Scalzi. I will move that House File 3420 be3248. Okay. I will move that 3248 be passed without recommendation to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if it's going to go to taxes right away. It may have to go to transportation. So I've talked to both chairs, and it may have to go to transportation first and then to taxes.
Do you want it to go to transportation first?
And what's your recommendation? Do you think it could go straight to taxes? It would be better for me to...
Transportation did not tell us they wanted it.
Okay.
So send it right to taxes.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
All right. Representative Scalzi.
And then I also have two amendments to 3248. In your packet, you have the AOH 1252 amendment.
All right. Representative Scalzi moves the...
And I have another one, too.
Okay. So why don't you move your first one?
I would move that to get it in the shape that I would like.
The AOH-1252, is that the one?
Actually, AOH-1199 would be the first one.
All right. Representative Scalzi moves the AOH-1199. All right. To get it in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And your second amendment, Representative Scalzi?
The second amendment would be the AOH-1252, which we produced after talking to some members of the business community, and so I would like that attached as well.
All right. Representative Scalzi moves the AO81252. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and committee members. A lot of you come from local government, and that's why you're here and on this committee, as do I. cities, we know the cities provide major services for our residents and our businesses. And the bulk of what cities provide is public safety, which is police and fire. But also, cities provide basic core services, which are water, sewer, and streets. And that affects all benefited properties in the city, and without those three core services, businesses and residents would not have as good a life as they do in our cities. They have assessments to all properties with hearings. What I call this bill is an assessment savings count, because assessments generally come in a large lump sum, and this is much like an assessment in the fact that it has a hearing required and a notice provided to all the residents and the taxpayers in the city. Assessments go to all properties, and generally, having been through quite a few assessment hearings in my years as a city council member, it's a lump sum of money that comes at one time. And this bill would help to alleviate that situation. It doesn't change the amount of money. It just helps bring it in a little bit at a time earlier so that it's not such a big hit to the property owner at one time. We know that we have sewer accounts that are enterprise accounts, water accounts that are enterprise accounts, which means that we charge not only for the service that's provided, but there's a small amount built in there for repairs and maintenance in the future, so that we don't have to have a jump in property taxes or a drop in property taxes. The intent is to keep them all fairly even. And so this bill, it would be for local streets to enable small cities and larger cities to be able to collect a little bit of money for a district at a slower period of time, so that it wouldn't be such a huge hit at the same time. Like I said, it's the same amount of money, but it just comes in at a slower rate. We have supporters, and there's people who are who don't support this bill, but the supporters that we do have is the City Engineers Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, Metro Cities, and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And they are all here if we need them to testify. In the interest of time, I just said who they were, and they're here if you decide to call them up, Mr. Chair. I'm here with Ann Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities, and also I have with me Public Works Director Mark Maloney from the City of Shoreview, and also City Council member from Bloomington. And I think we'll start with Mark Maloney.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Maloney. I'm the City Engineer and Public Works Director for the City of Shoreview, and I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities and the City Engineers Association on this topic. I wanted to start by just acknowledging and extending my appreciation to the legislature for the recent actions that have been taken to address comprehensive transportation funding for the state. These actions are going to help agencies address regional transportation issues. But today we're talking about the authority for street improvement districts, which would help cities address the funding issues for local infrastructure for the 80% of our local street system that typically includes residential streets that make up the neighborhoods where you and I live. The recent actions, the more comprehensive regional transportation funding issues that have been taken up by the legislature, will help us with 20% of our road system, the collector street system. It's the other 80% of, like I said, the residential streets that we're hoping can be addressed through the creation of street improvement districts. The condition of local street systems statewide have been suffering given the shortage of resources. And what's really sad is that having a dollar available at the right time to do preventative maintenance, on average, saves taxpayers from spending $6 in the future on something more expensive. Simply put, this proposed legislation would give local government another tool to address our infrastructure responsibilities. Cities in Minnesota typically use a combination of special assessments and the tax levy to fund local street projects. Both of these existing mechanisms can be problematic from the standpoint of affordability and fairness. Special assessments have always been difficult and costly for local government to administer. My community, Shoreview, recently incurred $15,000 of taxpayer-paid legal expenses to defend the $750 special assessment. We also believe the property tax system might not be the fairest way to apportion costs for certain types of infrastructure projects. These existing funding mechanisms available to us frequently don't allow us to have a coherent, long-range funding strategy to support what we already know is coming, and that is street improvement. Cities need a predictable, sustainable mechanism to help fund local transportation needs and protect public assets. This bill would give cities the authority to create, if necessary, a local transportation funding mechanism that would meet those needs. The process of identifying the infrastructure needs in a district, the apportionment of those costs, and the collection and dedication of those funds for that purpose would be completely transparent, as is the case for other types of infrastructure that cities are already accountable for. For that reason, the City Engineers Association and League of Minnesota Cities is asking your favorable consideration of proposed legislation.
All right. Anyone else?
Yes, the next testifier is Councilmember Steve Elkins from Bloomington.
Steve Elkins, I'm the District 3 Council member in Bloomington. Okay. In the discussions we've had with the business community regarding this bill, two main questions have arisen. The first one being, how much money do cities need in the context of the amounts that will receive an additional municipal state aid funding from the new transportation bill? Put that in perspective, this year Bloomington's share of the municipal state aid funds from the gas tax and the tab fees will be about $3.2 million. With the new bill, that's anticipated to increase to about $3.6 million in fiscal year 2009 and about $4 million in fiscal year 2010. Our pavement management program, which is covers all of the routine maintenance and reconstruction of city streets, doesn't include any of the new project expansion, is also about $3.2 million. And out of that, we fund about $1.9 out of that out of our levy, and about $1.3 million out of the share of MSA that we get. So the balance of our MSA is used for new construction. Overall, Bloomington's levy this year will be about $40 million, $40.7 million, including the levy for the pavement management program. And the reason I put that out to perspective is that we have one project on the books, which is the reconstruction of the intersection of 84th and Normandale, along with the associated changes in the street network within the Lake Normandale office complex. That will alone cost $41.2 million sometime in the next 5 years or so. We have one expansion project that is going to cost more than our entire city levy for the year. So the additions to the and MSA money that we're going to get out of from the new bill are barely scratching the surface in terms of our expansion needs. So the second question that has been posed to us is, how many tools do we need to address these kinds of situations? But using this project as an example, our funding plan for this project includes an anticipated $8 million in federal safety lieu grants administered through the Met Council, about $10.8 million in county grants and abatements from Hennepin County, $9 million in city abatements. But even so, that leaves us $13.4 million short, tapping everything that we can think of, and some of these are kind of speculative, that needs to be closed. So the way that this will be closed is that the vast majority of the land in the office park is controlled by three development firms who have agreed to voluntarily be assessed $13.4 million to close the gap and provide the full $41 million in funding. We're able to do that on a voluntary basis in this case because we've only got three developers to work with, and all of them want to do a significant additional development in this area. The employment concentration is anticipated to double from about 6,000 employees in that area today to about 11,000 to 13,000 employees when the office park is completely built out. We've got several of these coming up, the downtown Bloomington development, 35W494, Airport South, and it's going to be the same kind of a situation. So we need some sort of a tool, and in addition to the tools that we have, if Bloomington is going to accept the level of infill growth that the region expects us to accept over the next 10, 20 years. Without a tool like this, there just isn't anything there, because we aren't always going to have three cooperative developers in a redevelopment district that are going to be willing to accept voluntary assessments. Thank you.
Representative Colby, do you have anyone else that...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have Ann Finn here from the League of Minnesota Cities, if anyone has any questions for her, but in the interest of time, I think she'll take questions.
Questions for Representative Colby or the testifiers? Representative Markworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the fees versus property taxes, and I have a question on these districts. If you're, let's say, charging a certain fee, and let's say you've accumulated $200,000, but now the improvement costs $300,000, what do you do? Do you adjust the fees, or now do you put it on assessments or property taxes? How would you handle that? I know you have to have a five-year plan, but it looked like these districts can go up to a maximum of 20 years. So what if the fees you're bringing in doesn't match what the cost of your improvements are?
Representative Scalzi or Ms. Finn?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And Representative Markworth, we do anticipate that that could happen given the volatility and the cost of getting these projects done. And I would tell you that a city probably would have to go to the property tax for a project like that to make up the difference. However, we did put on an amendment today that would prohibit a city from doing special assessments for the same projects that they're funding in their plan with street improvement fees. So those projects could not be assessed in addition to being funded with the fees.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the other question comes down to kind of transparency and accountability. And at least when you have it on property taxes or assessments, you see it on your property tax statement, where a fee you're not going to. And so I'm really concerned about that, unless you've got some way in which the fee would show up. I guess I'm not sure, but sometimes would the fee show up on the property tax statement?
Representative Schulte.
Actually, the fee, as the bill states, would be up to the city to determine how that fee would show, whether it be on the utility bill or the property taxes. So it would be transparent. It would show. And it's much like a special assessment in the fact that there's a hearing. A notice would have to go out to all the property owners in the city, and then a hearing would be held.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Markworth.
I just found from experience that utility fees, if you put it on there, does not get nearly the scrutiny than your property tax levy. And I'm willing to bet that almost every city in this situation would put it on the utility billing rather than the property taxes. And I understand, you know, we know these costs of transportation is coming a lot out of the property taxpayer, but my big concern with this is the accountability, in that when you go through a regular assessment practice, the property owner knows exactly what the improvements are and what percent's going to be charged to the city overall and which will be charged just to the assessment. I guess, I mean, when you get to this accountability, how is this system more accountable than the property taxes?
I think I might take issue with one point. We finance our stormwater utility fee with the stormwater utility in Bloomington, and it shows up on the utility bill along with your water bill. And I get complaints about it all the time.
Yeah.
And it's right there. It's a line on the utility bill, and every 2 months when you get your water bill, it's right there in front of you.
Representative Biston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The statement about the prohibition against special assessments, I do see that now in one of the amendments. However, Subdivision 8 is still very broad, right, because there still are other ways in which municipalities could impose is the key word here, or imposing, as it's tense on 2.33, and I don't think that's right. You know, we're looking at some properties possibly taking a double or triple whammy depending upon what other measures the local unit of government wants to impose. I think if we're going to go down this road, then let's use this. So, yeah, I have a concern about this fee even versus special assessments, because special assessments have processes with, you know, which lay out how people can question, how people can come before, and that's written in the law. We're getting rid of any of those questioning mechanisms in this imposition of a fee. But I wonder, if the intent, by the amendment here is to eliminate the special assessment, I think there should be a complete elimination of any other imposition on properties to pay for this. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an oral amendment, if I could, please.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. On page 2, line 31, strike the word not. On page 2, line 32, strike the phrase does not restrict and insert restrict. And so in effect, the effect of that amendment, if we adopt it, would be to say, if this is the tool the local unit of government is going to use, right, then use this one and only this one. Right. Don't try and utilize other means and potentially double and triple hit a property owner.
The staff have the wording. Okay, discussion to the amendment. Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, the only problem would be that with the scenario that Representative Marquardt presented, if an improvement would be $200,000, but it really costs $300,000. There's only $200,000 in the account. There wouldn't be enough money to fund the entire improvement. At that point, the city has the only other means that the city has to do an improvement would be the property taxes, or taking from another line item in the city. But I can see what you're saying. I thought that the amendment would have prevented the city from double dipping on one project. The amendment that states that except that a municipality must not impose special assessments for projects funded with street improvement fees. So they wouldn't do it twice. And I understand your concern. I agree with that.
Representative Biskins, any further comments?
Madam Chair, and I don't know all of the taxing tools that are in the toolbox, and so while you've restricted the special assessment, and I appreciate that, you've restricted the hammer. Right? I don't know if there's a screwdriver or a wrench, and I'm trying to restrict all of the other tools in the toolbox.
All right. We're going to vote on this now, members. We have 12 minutes left in our regularly scheduled committee time. We have three bills left to be heard, as well as this one, and I want to give adequate time. I would encourage members to vote against the Biskins amendment. All right. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion does not prevail. All right. All right. Representative Scalzi, I'm going to ask if in the audience if there's anyone who wishes to testify for or against this bill. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and keep in mind that we're dealing with the local government issues here. No.
Madam Chair?
Or Representative Holbert.
Can I ask a question of Chair Marquardt while they're coming down?
Certainly. Representative Holbert.
Thank you. Chair Marquardt, I don't function in the property tax realm, but I know that there's relief programs for low-income and large property tax bills, circuit breakers, I think sometimes they're called, or whatever. Would these fees feed into that calculation at all, or would they be outside of that for our most financially strapped fee payers?
Representative Marquardt.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, that would not be part of a property tax relief or circuit breaker program.
All right, thank you.
Refund.
Representative Marquardt, would the special assessment be? I don't think it is.
No.
I just want to know if this is the same or if they would be different between the two.
Representative Lentesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't believe it is. We could check and find out. But special assessments have to have a proportional benefit to the property. It is illegal. So the property owner has to get something for this new improvement. So it's not a property tax per se. If your property is being improved, then you're therefore being assessed, and you're benefiting from the improvements to the property. All right. And, Madam Chair?
Representative Holberg.
And to that point, if you are in a limited income situation with a special assessment, you can defer that assessment until the property is sold. So if you're on a fixed income or whatever, there is some way to address that as opposed to a fee which would be due every month or whatever.
I'm going to go to the testifiers. Was that a question?
No, I just want to make the point that this fee is different and that there'd be very little relief for low-income people to have to pay this fee.
All right. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am representing NIA, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. We represent the interests of owners, developers, and managers of business properties throughout North America, and basically we house thousands and thousands of businesses in our buildings through communities across the state. And it kind of struck me when I first heard about this bill. I reflected back to the transportation debate and some of the comments that were made from the debate. With this bill, I am voting to avoid higher property taxes. Without this bill, the cities and counties will have no choice but to go to their primary source of funding, our real estate taxes, to get their transportation needs, funding needs met. The money in this bill for street repair and improvements will stop increases in our property taxes. The gas tax and vehicle fees could mean a reduction in property taxes that some cities have used to repair local roads in years when street or state funding for transportation was inadequate. So now we find that local jurisdictions want additional authority to impose special property taxes on property owners to fund street improvements, to raise yet more money for transportation needs, and you can't help but ask, is there ever going to be enough money? And as commercial real estate developers, we're particularly sensitive to this because, and very skittish, because we have found over the last 10 or 20 years, as Councilmember Elkins referenced, that when a new development or redevelopment occurs, the developer is often asked, and it is not always voluntary, to pick up the cost, any kind of a gap in transportation funding needs, whether a road needs to be improved, a bridge needs to be repaired, or whatever needs to be done in order to accommodate that new development. And now, in addition to those costs, the property taxes and special assessments that we pay and the tenants, the employers, and our buildings pay, we're yet looking at another funding mechanism for transportation. So we get real nervous about this. And I have to say also that I am really kind of confused about the transparency issue and the accountability issue in here, because one of the things that struck me is I do not believe that people scrutinize their utility bills as much as they do property tax statements, and at least if it's on the property tax bill, as a taxpayer in a local jurisdiction, you know how much you're paying for the cost of services you're asking for and are getting from your local unit of government, and to spread those costs over a lot of different bills, the taxpayer gets confused, and that's part of why they get a little bit jaded about the system. Thank you for letting me talk.
All right, go ahead. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We do respectfully oppose this bill on behalf of the rental housing owners, apartment and condominium owners and managers, and of course the renters who pay all the fees through the rent that they pay. A comment that I'd like to make, Madam Chairman, based on other comments, this does expand tremendously the municipal powers to create essentially a whole new property tax system. It's a tax on property, and it's an entirely new, totally discretionary system. Current statute, I checked this just for interest, current Minnesota statute, even if you just take the essence of our property tax system, not even the appeals and all the other side issues, chapters 272 to 273, 174 pages of property tax law that's been created over many decades, bipartisan, with exceptions, with apportioning out the payments to the classes of property as the legislature, after countless, hundreds, thousands of hours of discussion and debate has determined this is the way it should be. And with one stroke in a bill that contains literally two sentences directing how the new property tax system would work, totally abolishes that system, and we don't know what they would do. Would they give disabled homeowners a benefit? Current law does. Would they apportion the taxes among large rental and small rental, large business, small business? There's no way of knowing. We don't know what they would do. And the money they're talking about is huge. I mean, right-of-way, bridges, total street acquisition and construction and reconstruction, sewers, lights, bridges. I mean, huge kinds of expenditures that could be put upon properties in any configuration that the city deems that they wanted to do it. In essence, it's kind of a circumventing the property tax system. So you ask, why? Why would they do this? They have the power to tax property already. Well, our fear, of course, is that it would be very easy to make the renters and the business property pay a disproportionate share, pay more. We already pay more than homesteads do. And that's what the law is. That's the current law. This would allow unlimited transferring of payments to business and to rental properties without any test or without any discrimination or without any totally at their discretion. Also, these properties would, of course, naturally be paying full property taxes in addition. No one says they wouldn't be paying property taxes. Finally, 2 points, Madam Chair. The amendment that says that a city would have to consider the general benefit to property completely as an end run around the special assessment law with all its court cases that have interpreted benefit to property. A requirement to consider benefit does not give us a whole lot of comfort. One final point, Madam Chair, regarding Councilmember Elkins' discussion of his reconstruction of 84th and Normandale. I think 2 points emerged from that testimony. Number one, they got the job done. Between TIF, special tax abatements, whatever property tax use, negotiated development agreements whereby the developers, commonly used by cities, whereby the developers agreed to pay for the driveway and the street access. So number one, they got the job done. It's not an argument why they need this bill. Secondly, what would this bill do for them? What would they do? Let's say they wanted to get more money to reconstruct that. Would they create some kind of a gerrymandered district that just includes other businesses? Or would they go out a mile and include all the homes? Can you see the homeowners being charged, say, $1,000 or $2,000 a year to come up with $13 million for a business interchange? It doesn't seem very likely. I think the businesses and the renters would be very vulnerable in that situation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to ask that you be very brief because we are supposed to adjourn this meeting in 3 minutes. We can have the room for 15 more minutes. We are going to take up all of the bills, and if we don't finish, we're coming back tonight. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair members. My name is Alyssa Slander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I will be very brief. I'll cut my comments short and just try to answer what Representative Biskins was trying to say earlier about the questioning about all the different sources of tax revenue that the cities currently have available to them to be able to fund street maintenance. And a bunch of us were just trying to scratch that out as we were listening to the debate, and we came up with about 9 sources. They've got development agreements, they can issue bonds, there's LDA, there are TIF districts, special assessments, state transportation aid, the property tax, obviously. And also, we just wanted to note that the state auditor's report of expenditures and debts of Minnesota cities shows that fees and charges that cities have collected for streets and highways have increased by 45% between the years 2001 and 2005, and I don't even know what is included in that line item. So I echo the comments of my colleagues that have raised concerns about this bill, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. State your name. Please be very, very brief.
Madam Chair, my name is Jamie Poole. I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. In respect of time, I just want to acknowledge our opposition to this bill also. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota, and also in respect of time, would like to tell you that we oppose the measures that are being presented in the bill and stop at that for now.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Seeing no one else, is there any other member who has a question? It is my intent to lay this bill over. So, questions from members before we proceed?
All right. Madam Chair, if I might, your intent to lay it over, will you notice this if you're going to bring it back up ahead of time?
I would.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I had not anticipated testifying today. Dave Engstrom, Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We represent about 350 cities under 5,000 in Minnesota. Just for the record, we do support this bill, and cities under 5,000 get absolutely no money from the transportation bill. They don't get any Minnesota state aid money, and this is a tool in the toolbox for those small cities for both redevelopment districts, residential districts, also residential street repair. Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Scalzi, I'm going to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thanks to the committee for your time. And just remember that this bill is very transparent. It has hearings, notice to all the affected property owners. So just keep that in mind. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Representative Gardner. Can you be fast? All right, I will move that House File 3238 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. We have an author's amendment, and I will move House File 3238A4 to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Gardner, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shall I confine my comments to the local government parts of the bill?
Yes, you should.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill promotes a conservation rate structure for public water suppliers with the interest of conserving our drinking water supplies. It does not get really specific about how to do that. There are lots of, pardon the cliche, tools in the toolbox that local governments can use. With the rate structures and working with their commercial and residential customers to discourage waste and the use of drinking water for other purposes. And that's it, Madam Chair.
All right. Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. One last call. Any questions for members? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3238 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, I have the next two bills, and I'm going to do it from here because I want to get out of here in the next 15 minutes. All right, I would move that House File 3114 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register, and I do have a 3114A1 amendment that would put it in the order, the A2 amendment, excuse me, that would put the bill in the order I wanted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, gentlemen, make it fast. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Court Holt, representing Three Rivers Park District, and we're here with the bill today. It's a simple bill that would synchronize the portion of the Metropolitan Parks Act with the older law that is our enabling statute in a certain area. With me is Mr. Bo Carlson from the Three Rivers Park District and the chairman of the Board
of... Just one second. Those of you that are leaving the room, please do so quietly. You're disrupting and we're trying to get done. So please continue.
Larry Blackstead, and I think that they can explain this bill in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Great. Go ahead.
3 or 4 minutes.
Great. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Bo Carlson. I'm an associate superintendent with Three Rivers Park District. For the sake of time, I'll be very brief in my comments. As Mr. Horton mentioned, this is an alignment of our previous enabling legislation with the Metropolitan Land Planning Act of 1974. Three Rivers Park District is a regional park agency representing suburban Hennepin Park District, or suburban Hennepin area. We were established in 1957 by the state legislature, and that included when we were acquiring properties within municipalities, it was a requirement at that time that we have local approval on that acquisition. With the creation of the Metropolitan Land Planning Act of 1974, there was a process as part of the regional parks program to create master plans, development of park boundaries, those master plans are then adopted by the communities that then are represented within their comprehensive plans, and then ultimate adoption by the Metropolitan Council. Those then become the guiding documents for us with land acquisition by which we move forward with any properties that we are acquiring. In all of these situations, there have been properties that have been identified. We always approach a willing seller basis for acquisition. And again, the cities have adopted these properties in their comprehensive plans. We are just following through with that action. This is, in essence, to clear up a redundancy. It's something that was created back when the law changed in 1974, so we feel it's a relatively technical change and a small change, and just cleaning up some of that language that is there.
Right.
With that, I would like to turn over to our board chair, Mr. Larry Blackstead.
All right, go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Larry Blackstead. I'm chairman of Three Rivers Park District Board. In the respective time, I'll just stand there. Any questions you may have?
All right. Representative Gears.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any of the testifiers, actually, just people making this purchase without resolution, are they appointed or they elected? Then a follow-up.
We'd like it.
Our board is comprised of 5 elected and 2 appointed. 2 of the members are appointed by the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners.
Madam Chair and members are that to the testifiers. A part-time purchase without resolution of consent. Who would issue that resolution of consent in a normal transaction again? Yeah, that we're going to operate without?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, in the situation, the resolution of support that we would be seeking would be a resolution by the community. If that resolution was waived, then this provision is delineated in their comprehensive plan for the city, and it would be a purchase between the park district and the property owner upon the property owner's approval. So we would be following what the city had already designated within its comprehensive plan and ordinances as well.
Madam Chair, what I'm seeking is that there is election certificates touching this process somewhere along the way, because someone has to be accountable to voters. That's what I'm seeking. So apparently there is, then.
There is.
Thank you.
All right. Further questions, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There may be election certificates, but I don't know if the certificate holders necessarily have to represent the areas where the land is being purchased. And I think that's an important caveat. I'm not sure the city of Jordan wants the mayor of Bloomington making decisions which affect the city of Jordan. My question to the testifiers is, do we have in front of us a solution in search of a problem, i.e., is there problems out there right now where you cannot get this resolution? Most governing bodies meet at least once a month. We're talking about major land purchases. I don't know why it would be so difficult to get a resolution, but maybe I'm wrong. Has it been a problem getting these resolutions?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, to address your first question, in the instance of suburban Hennepin Park District, or Three Rivers Park District, we represent Hennepin County. This change in the law would only affect Hennepin County. If we were acquiring property outside of Hennepin County, where we do currently own properties in Scott County, for instance, we would still require a certification or a certificate of resolution by the county itself. So we would still need county approval and properties outside of Hennepin County. This would only affect Hennepin County itself. Where we have found a problem in the past has been when we do have a willing seller, a property owner that is ready to sell the property. We have come to an agreement on that price, and because of local politics or whatever local issue may be, that individual property owner has found themselves on the wrong side of some internal politics that are going on within that city, and for whatever reason they're denied the sale of their personal property. Which has caused property owners to hire attorneys on their own and force contesting of that either lack of support from the municipality or some delay that the municipality may cause.
Representative Biskin.
And thank you, Madam Chair. But I can understand where the concern would be if a person is selling property which is currently taxable property to the local unit of government, and now selling it to Three Rivers, of course, takes it off the tax rolls, and in effect then becomes a tax increase to the remaining taxpayers, remaining property taxpayers. So I think those are things that the local unit of government probably has to weigh when these sales are pending, and I think then it's very appropriate that there is give and take between Three Rivers and the local unit of government so that you can get to yes together, and that getting to yes together is then expressed via the resolution.
Mr. Holton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Biskins, bear in mind that the city involved has already designated this property as park and open space, and those political and financial calculations have already been argued and made, and they've placed this as designated as park and open space in their comprehensive plan, which has then become part of the park district's boundary, which then has become part of the Metro Council's master plan. And when these properties are eventually offered for sale to become part of the park district, the existing structure also provides, I think it's a 5-year cushion on the departing property tax. That's all part of an agreement that was initially made between the city, the park district, and the Met Council. So this is really has been thoroughly decided and planned.
One final question, Representative.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't belabor the point, but by Mr. Holton's testimony right here, members, we have a solution in search of a problem. If his testimony is accurate and this has all been laid out in advance, then we have a solution in search of a problem.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, I will renew. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3114 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Motion no.
Prevails. All right, next, I will move that House File 3420 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register, and I have an amendment. It's the 3420A1 amendment, and there does need to be an oral amendment to that amendment, changing the effective date to August 1st of 2008. That is, where is that? Page 5, line 19. And page 4, line 6. Representative Biskins?
Madam Chair, maybe staff can help. Would it not be easier just to strike the effective date?
Ms. Lafitte. No, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins is correct. The default effective date on non-appropriation bill is August 1st of the year.
All right, so the motion is to delete the effective date. Thank you, Representative. All right. So all those in favor of the amendment that puts the bill in the order the author would like it, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, my name is Joel Beckman. I'm the Director of Property Taxation and Records for Dakota County. I'm here today representing the Minnesota County Recorders Association. I will try to be brief. This bill, in essence, deletes some obsolete language and clarifies how fees are to be applied for filing amendments to common interest communities, documents, and condominiums within the state of Minnesota. It is revenue neutral. It clarifies how the fees are to be applied. It does not add additional fees.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.